Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is March the 31st, a Sunday, 2024, the last day of March, Easter Sunday, but we broadcast every day of the year. I told my wife I was doing a show on Easter Sunday. She said, "What kind of people are available for interviews on an Easter Sunday?" Well, I found someone, a young woman called, maybe not so young, but certainly younger than I am, Becca Rothfeld, the book critic of the Washington Post, one of the young literary lions, or lionesses at least, of the East Coast. She is the woman, at least according to her Substack series of essays, who's helping put the id back in Yid, which probably explains why she's available on Easter Sunday. She has a new book out, All Things Are Too Small, Essays in Praise of Excess. And I thought it might be interesting to begin with Becca talking, given it's Easter Sunday, about the Bible. We did a show earlier this week with the biblical historian Candida Moss, God's Ghostwriters, Enslaved Christians and the Making of the Bible, which is an interesting thesis from Moss, that the Bible was written by many people, including slaves. And in Becca's thesis on size, she talks about books never being big enough. She writes, "Books can be big, most of the best ones are, yet even the most encyclopedic affairs are too small to encompass the whole of the world's wild machinery." Becca, is the Bible an attempt to write a big book, do you think, even if there's some dispute about its authors who actually wrote it?
I think so. I mean, I think that the Bible might be the first encyclopedic book in the tradition of books like Moby Dick or Berlin Alexander Plots. It does seem to be an attempt to encompass everything. But sort of by its own admission, the Bible encourages people to strive for something beyond the world. And so that's kind of the guiding idea of the book, is that we're always going to want more here on earth. Even though I am obviously a very Jewish person, putting the id back in Yid comes from Philip Roth's Portnoy's Complaint, one of my favorite books and an extremely Jewish book. I think this is a yearning perhaps common to all religions. And it's something in the Christian religion that appeals to me also, is that there's a yearning for more than we could ever have on earth, hence the promise of heaven. I think that's even in the Bible, local scholar.
It's interesting you bring up Roth. We've done lots of shows on him. We even did a show on a festival, literary festival, about Roth earlier this year in Newark, New Jersey. Are you a revisionist? I mean, I'm not sure if you write explicitly about Roth in the book itself, in the collection of essays, but are you suggesting that his focus on size is a good one, and that we shouldn't be too critical of his literary ambition?
I don't write about Roth in the book, and I don't know that I would say that he focuses on size, but I do enjoy his sort of voracious appetites. I mean, as particularly in Portnoy's Complaint, obviously the protagonist of that book is very voracious sexually, and that's something that I appreciate. And the prose is really like beautiful and maximalist. I don't think that Roth's ambition is the part that we need to be a revisionist about. If we were going to be revisionists about anything, it would probably be his sexism, but I think that his sexism is compatible with his literary genius. That's never really been a tension that bothered me too much. And I don't think that his character sexism is glorified in the books. Characters like Portnoy, I don't think are made to look like particularly good people. But I do think that is a book that is very much in Portnoy's Complaint, that is very much in the spirit of my book, and that it's an excessive and hungry and maximalist book. The form of the book is excessive. There's lots of ranting and long sentences. Let's put the id back in Yid. Maybe the best line in the book is capitalized, if I recall correctly. So that delights me.
It's an American book, or perhaps you're an American writer, just as Rawls was, of course. You have this description in one of the essays, which was published in The New Yorker. You write, "I once saw a man in a restaurant finish his pasta, order the same dish again, eat it, then order and finish it a third time. His was the sanest response to his predicament." Are you suggesting that there's a rationality to excessive appetite? It reminds me almost of that scene in Monty Python, you know, where the man kept on eating and ordering and then popped.
Yeah, there's an amazing scene in Budenbrook's Thomas Mann's first book, which I think is underappreciated because I've never seen anyone discuss this particular scene. The book is not underappreciated, but this scene is, where one of the characters and his senility, he's old, he eats himself to death. He like buys a ton of cakes and basically eats himself to death. And I think that there's something beautiful about that. But I do think that it's rational. And maybe this goes back to what I was saying about the Bible. I do think that the human predicament is one of feeling acutely and suffering from our finitude. We understand that our lives are finite in terms of time, in terms of what we're able to do, in terms of what we're able to have. So I do think that it's rational to strive for more. That might be one reason why maybe it's rational to be religious in some senses, and that it is rational to want more than you could ever have and within the confines of your finite life. Perhaps also rational for that man to order three plates of pasta, although I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, we'll have to watch that man in the restaurant. In collections of essays, Becca, you know this as a book reviewer, you're always looking for messages, for broader arguments, meta themes. Is one in this book an attack on Puritanism, on restraint?
I think that that is the guiding theme of the book. I think it's also a bunch of essays in praise of excess is the subtitle. It's essays in praise of excess, but I think that they really are essays in praise of gratuity, essays in praise of having more than you need, more than is just required for subsistence. And I think that a lot of strains of what I would call contemporary Puritanism of different kinds, and I discuss several kinds in the book, are anti-gratuity. They say that you should only have what you need in terms of both physical possessions, in terms of emotional attachments. And I think that that is a recipe for an impoverished life.
It's the Marie Kondo school, the Christine Ember school. We'll get to both of those characters who you're not great fans of later. The philosopher, you were a philosophy student at Harvard, and as you suggest, you still might be one day. Do you think the philosophers, or certainly the Puritan philosophers, got it wrong? That restraint reflects weakness rather than strength, and that the real strength, and maybe there's a Nietzschean element here, is excess, is the satisfaction of appetite?
Sure that I would say that it's a matter of strength, but rather a matter of expressing one's humanity. I mean, I think that Puritanism reflects a confusion about what humanity consists in. I think that what makes us human in general and what makes us the particular people we are is various kinds of accumulation. And I don't just mean accumulation of physical possessions, although that is one way that I think you become the person you are. Not necessarily commodities, but accumulation of heirlooms from your family, works of art, letters from loved ones, cards from your friends on your birthday, but accumulations of attachments and encumberments and relationships. I think these are the things that make us people. So that's what I think that Puritanism is confused about. Puritanism of various kinds. Marie Kondo's minimalism and Puritanism about sexual relations as well, I think are confused about the human aspect of these activities of accumulation and eroticism.
We know then what we don't like about the American tradition. It's the little city on the hill, at least according to you. You don't put it in quite in those terms, but that New England tradition of Puritan settlers. Is there an American tradition that you look back at, if not with nostalgia, certainly with gratitude?
I mean, I think that America is such an enormous and diverse country that there surely are some, and there surely are some that I'm not even familiar with. I'm an East Coastal Jew, so my frame of reference is pretty limited. It does seem to me that many aspects of the Black tradition in America are much more the kind of thing that I have in mind, like the tradition of jazz music, New Orleans is a insane place that's super excessive. Things like Mardi Gras might be more in line with what I have in mind. I'm not super familiar with the West, places like Colorado. Those places are physically excessive and that they're enormous and there's enormous mountains. So that might be more in line with what I have in mind. There certainly are also, there's an American literary tradition of writing really long encyclopedic novels. I mentioned Moby Dick before. Other entries in this genre might include Infinite Jest or the books of William Gaddis. Those are books that are excessive in the way that I envision, although they certainly also have European and particularly German language antecedents, stuff like Berlin Alexanderplatz and The Man Without Qualities.
You keep on bringing up these Central European Man Without Qualities, the Buddenbrooks. What about American writers?
I mean, I think that this is perhaps a matter of personal preference. I certainly don't want to go on the record saying that I think the American tradition is worse than the German language.
You can say it, Rebecca. I don't mind.
I'm not sure that I think it. It's just I've always been personally more attracted to the European tradition and particularly the German one. German philosophy was one of the things that I focused on when I was getting my PhD at Harvard. I didn't finish my PhD, but when I was working towards my PhD at Harvard, I was always really attracted to these giant works of systematic philosophy, stuff like Hegel, Heidegger's Being and Time, Phenomenology of Spirit, in the French tradition, stuff like Being and Nothingness. Maybe those are kind of the philosophical analog of these encyclopedic books that I have in mind, these big systemic tomes that are an attempt to grapple with everything. So that's kind of my preferred tradition, I suppose. Although, of course, there are plenty of American examples. It's just the German tradition that I gravitate towards for whatever reason.
Are there some negative models of alternatives to Puritanism? Of course, in the American context, there's the experience of slavery in the American South where excess was celebrated, but of course it was excess built off other people's labor. How does the Southern tradition in literary, philosophical, and political terms fit into your argument?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that much. I mean, I will say that makes me think of Faulkner, who I do think writes excessively in much the way that I envision. I mean, he's such a luscious prose stylist, and he's one of my favorite American authors. And there are other people like Flannery O'Connor, people from the South that I admire, although I'm not an expert or connoisseur of the Southern tradition. But certainly there are negative kinds of excess. The book is not an argument in favor of every kind of excess. It's a book in favor of gratuity in particular, as I said. And so, I mean, there's many examples spring to mind, many American examples. I mean, just accumulation for the sake of accumulation, rampant capitalistic accumulation, certainly slavery. I mean, another artistic strain, which is obviously less abhorrent than slavery, but I think is another example of bad maximalism, is Marvel movies, a lot of these really pointlessly long, really over the top action movies that are really popular in America and are made in America. The Dune movies, maybe another example. I think that they're pointlessly excessive. There's nothing glorious about it. It's just flashy and empty. So that's another example of a gratuitously, in the bad way, maximalist American tradition. I could probably think of others too.
Yeah, it seems as if American history is made up of excess. First we had slavery, then the excess of the Civil War, then the excess of the late 19th century, and then of course the 1920s. Perhaps the great critic of excess in the early 20s was Fitzgerald's Gatsby. What would you make of that? I mean, wasn't he warning against excess? Wasn't he in favor of restraint? Wasn't that perhaps a brilliant polemic against excess?
I mean, I guess it's interesting that I think that maybe there are two competing American traditions. And of course, I'm generalizing because, again, it's such an enormous country with so many divergent subcultures. But there is, on the one hand, this culture of Puritanism, which, although it is geographically localized to the East Coast, I do think that there is a sort of Protestant ethos that is in some ways nationwide. And then on the other hand, there are these pockets of kind of crass commercialist excess. And I wonder if even when there are moments of excess in American culture, they're kind of guilty in a way. There isn't an embrace of spiritual or artistic excess. There's just capitalist accumulation that's kind of always apologizing for itself and also rooting itself in what Weber called the Protestant work ethic. One of the essays that I cite in my book, which is really good on this topic, is this essay by William Gass, the American critic, who's another great example of an excessive writer. He writes stylistically, it's so rich. It's like eating like a decadent chocolate cake or something to read him because he's such a rich writer. And he has this essay called Simplicities, where he kind of talks about like the American fetishization of the simple, plain spoken farmer type of person. So I think that there's always been a skepticism in America of artistic excesses, or, you know, even of intellectualism. It's in some ways a very anti-intellectual culture. Although, of course, that's generalizing. There are obviously exceptions and so on. I also think that at this moment in particular, there is an emphasis on minimalism in lots of aspects of American culture, maybe not unique even to American culture, because these are homogenizing trends and global trends. But even if there were other periods in the past where that wasn't quite as true, I think that that's certainly true now.
Do you think that this fashion for minimalism, the popularity of people like Kondo and Ember, reflects a kind of guilt of the American elite class on the two coasts about inequality? I think you wrote about this, a compensation for inegalitarianism, and that we're not comfortable perhaps with the world we live in, so we embrace minimalism, which levels the playing field, but of course it's not really a level playing field.
Yeah, I definitely think that that is a huge part of what's happening. I mean, in the book, I say that this is something that people on the left, and I consider myself on the left, do a lot of the time. And I guess I'm doing some psychologizing and imagining why they're such proponents of cultural egalitarianism. But the argument is that because we on the left have failed so miserably to secure political and economic egalitarianism, we overcompensate by trying to enforce egalitarianism in the cultural realm by insisting that things like Marvel movies are just as good as works of high cinema or whatever. And so it's a compensatory mechanism. But I hadn't considered, and now I am considering, and I think it's quite plausible, that also people more on the right or wealthy, extravagant people might also be enforcing cultural minimalism out of a sense of guilt. That seems like the complementary gesture, I guess.
We are attacking today on Easter Sunday, perhaps an appropriate day for this, attacking all things small with my guest, Becca Rothfeld, the book critic of the Washington Post. Her new collection, or her first collection of essays, All Things Too Small, has been really brilliantly reviewed. It got great reviews in the New York Times, and particularly in The Guardian. I want to take a short break to thank our friends at Liberties, wonderful new publication, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for helping us bring amazing guests like Becca Rothfeld on Easter Sunday. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Becca to talk more specifically about the crisis. I think we touched on it in the last part of our conversation. The crisis of liberalism in the context of her thesis, and what are we going to do about it? So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with the acclaimed essayist, Becca Rothfeld, the author of a wonderful new collection of essays, All Things Are Too Small. She's also the book critic on the Washington Post. Becca, you had a really interesting piece last July about conservatism, arguments for an unmodern America. People like Patrick Deneen, who's had many invitations to his show. He never seems to come on. I'm sure if he gets my emails. But you, the essay is a good critique of Deneen and Amari and another new conservative. But I think the real interesting thing in the essay was your take on perhaps the crisis of liberalism in the context both of new conservatism and the way in which perhaps liberalism has retreated into the small. Is that fair? Or am I overreading your review?
I mean, I think that there's a crisis of liberalism insofar as I think that liberalism is totally misunderstood. And there's little bits of this in the essay collection, but it's also something that I just independently have tons of thoughts about because I was really into the liberal philosopher John Rawls in my PhD program. If we were in a room in my house, I could show you. I have like a giant portrait of Rawls. I have like a crochet doll of Rawls. Like, I love Rawls.
No longer there. Unfortunately, we have you in literary criticism rather than academic philosophy. We did a show on, we've done lots of shows on Rawls. We did one, I'm sure you're familiar with his new book, Daniel Chandler.
Yes, I've actually read it.
He looked like on Easter, every day is Easter for Chandler. He was trying to resurrect Rawls. What's wrong with Rawls? Why do you think Rawls is a sort of a symptom, perhaps, of our crisis?
Well, I don't think that Rawls is a symptom of our crisis. I think that Rawls is great, but I think that he's totally misunderstood. I mean, I think that, as I was saying earlier in the segment, I think that what we should have egalitarianism in the political and economic domain, and that having egalitarianism in those domains would allow us to be inegalitarian in the cultural or romantic domain. It would be less harmful to people to say, your book is bad and this other book is better, or this movie is bad and this other movie is better. You should like these things and not these things in the cultural domain if there were a baseline of economic equality, because then even if there were differentials in prestige or acclaim or admiration, those things wouldn't have horrible effects on people's lives. So I think that Rawls is one of the most eloquent and ingenious exponents of a vision for political and economic egalitarianism that would allow for excess and maximalism in private life, even as there is egalitarianism and proportion in public life. And so in the beginning of the book, I talk a little bit about Rawls, where I say, Rawls's vision for political community, I think, is a great one because it provides a good basis and background from which we can go on to pursue excess.
You talk about, maybe we'll get to inegalitarianism in the cultural domain, but you mentioned inegalitarianism in the romantic domain. We had your friend or your frenemy, Christine Ember, who I also think writes for the Washington Post on the
show. Not anymore. She went to the Atlantic very recently.
She's gone. Well, you're still probably a friend of hers. And we titled the show Sex, 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 Why We're Not Having It and Why That's Bad, although she seemed to, I'm not sure she would necessarily agree. What is inegalitarianism in the romantic domain, Becca? And why is Christine Ember, why is she one of the symbols of what's gone wrong?
Well, one aspect that I think is separate from Emma's arguments, which I'll get to in a second, is just that obviously the romantic domain and just the interpersonal domain is one of inequality because we prefer people over others. I think that that's at the core of what love is, at least for humans. I hate to say that on Easter because I know that Christian love, agape, which I might be
pronouncing. You're allowed to do it on Easter. My wife's not here, or I should cut you off.
Yeah, this is one of the privileges of being a Jew, is that you can say things like this.
We just can broadcast on Easter. Nobody else can.
That's true. One of our many benefits. But yeah, so preferring one person over another is one way in which love and friendship are just inegalitarian enterprises. My critique of Emba is a critique of maybe a different aspect. It's a critique of the attempt to render all sexual activity kind of utilitarian or instrumentalize it. So this returns to the stuff I was saying about gratuity. I think that sex is surprising and it's delightful. It's like art. It's something that we don't necessarily need to do, but that we can enjoy, and it humanizes us because it's something that we choose to do. Whereas I think that Christine Emba and other critics of the sexual revolution often think that sex should be for something else. It's a means to the end of something else. Some people think it's a means to the end of procreation, and that's all it should be. I don't think that Emba who is my friend, but she knows that I disagree with her about this. She doesn't say that explicitly in her book, but she does sort of imply that it is a means to the end of affecting romantic connection of some kind, that there's no other reason why you should have sex. She also thinks that sex should be very safe and comfortable, that if you are surprised during sex or transformed during sex or unsettled during sex, something has gone wrong. Whereas I argue in multiple essays in the book that the erotic is a domain of surprise, and that's what it should be. You should be surprised by the singularity of another person, and you should be surprised by the way that they can have transformative effects on you. So I don't think that the end goal of sexual ethics is to render sex safe and sanitary. And she's one of several people that I criticize. I think that there's a tradition of kind of, there's an emerging tradition of right and center-right commentators who think that what we need to be doing is making the sexual domain as safe as possible. This is an interesting point of convergence, I think, between some people on the left and some people on the right.
Yeah, and you had an interesting review of Judith Butler, who you were, sounded ambivalent about. And for you, all good sex is body horror. is sex for you the new, speaking on Easter, Becca, is sex the new religion or your religion?
I don't think sex is my religion. I guess I think that maybe literature is more my religion than sex. But I think actually I get similar things from both of them, which is an encounter with someone outside of myself. There's a really great Iris Murdoch quote, which I'm probably going to mangle from memory, but it's something like, love is the very difficult realization that something other than the self exists. And I think that that is what sex at its best is, and also what literature at its best is. So maybe jolting encounters with something outside of the self is my religion. And that could include actual traditional religion as well.
Is there an irony, Becca, I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask you this, on a book, a collection of essays, and it's a smallish book, Essays in Praise of Excess. Shouldn't you have written the next American novel? Shouldn't this be a 600-page style book? Can you praise excess in few words?
Yeah, well, so two things. First is that many of the essays are actually quite long for essays. Like the longest essay in the book, I believe, is 20,000 words, which is like almost a novella length or something. And a lot of them, about half of the essays numerically were previously published in other publications, but then I think 5 or 6 of them are new essays. And because I didn't have any word limit, they weren't for magazines. Almost all of those are like 10,000 plus words. So they're quite long for essays. Even though the overall book is small. But the second point is that I think that the kind of maximalism I'm in praise of is not just length for length's sake, it's gratuity. It's more than you need. And so I was on another podcast talking about the book, and we were talking about short stories on that podcast. And I was saying that, like, I think that there are lots of short stories that are quite short in length. Some of them even almost aphoristic, like some stories of Kafka's are almost aphoristic, but nonetheless are maximalist in this sense. And there's different ways of being maximalist. Like some of Kafka's stories gesture at kind of nightmarish architectural structures that go on infinitely. And that's a way of being maximalist, even in a short story that's like 200 words or something.
You've written some interesting stuff on men too. Who hasn't? I saw a piece about the so-called crisis of men in crisis on your Substack. Men in crisis. I'm not sure how ironic or otherwise you were in this. We've done lots of shows on the supposed crisis of men. When with Richard Reeves, who's at Brookings, whose new book on, he's serious about the crisis of men, is very successful and controversial. How important is sexual and gendered politics? You just wrote an interesting piece on Judith Butler as well. How important is the politics of gender and of men and women in the 2020s in this essay, collection of essays?
I guess it is and it isn't. I mean, it's not, it's something I've written about a lot, not in the book. Like I wrote a review of Josh Hawley, the horrible American politician, horrible super right-wing American politician. He had a book about masculinity that I think is called Manliness. So I wrote a negative, obviously, review of that book. I had a debate actually with Christine Emba, and there's a podcast, I think, of the debate.
Yeah, from I saw that. It's from the Aspen
yeah.
Festival.
Yeah, yeah. We did a live event in DC where we were debating whether there's a crisis of masculinity. And I'm skeptical that there is a crisis of masculinity. So I don't tackle that explicitly in this book, but I do talk about, I guess, multiplicity and the desire for multiplicity, the desire to have more than one self, or the way in which different kinds of transformative encounters can jolt and thereby change you, not just sexual encounters, but encounters with art and encounters with unexpected things of all kinds. And so I think that is relevant to my conception of what is so stifling about traditional ways of understanding gender, even though that's not something I explicitly say in the book. Maybe if you read a wider sample of my work, you could see that the relationship is that I think that the traditional binary conceptions of gender are quite stifling because they don't allow people to embrace a multiplicity of ways of being in the world. And so that's maybe a connection between my commitment to excess and my distaste for the gender binary as it has been traditionally conceived.
Becca, what should the America of your kind of excess look like? All too often on this show, I have progressives who come on and do the standard critique of America. And I say, well, that's all very well. What should America look like? And they always come back to the same thing. They want America to look like Denmark, tidy, neat, maybe the Marie Kondo of political cultural systems. Can America be large and good in the context of the ideas you're putting together in this narrative? And what does it look like?
So one thing I would say is that I don't know if Denmark is so tidy. I mean, there's like Kierkegaard, they have a good
culture. Well, they leave their bicycles in the street, right?
Yes, yes. So I mean, I guess one thing that I can say is that I think that there's a principled reason why I can't give a great answer. And that's because part of my commitment is to allowing yourself to be surprised or shocked even. And so I think if you were to lay out exactly what would emerge in the kind of world that I'm envisioning, that would eliminate the element of surprise that I'm so committed to. But I guess my vision for America would be Rawlsian economic egalitarianism, which is outlined, the way that you would go about that is outlined pretty extensively in Rawls's enormous book, Theory of Justice. And then I think that that would allow for different cultural configurations to arise. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that having like a well-functioning social democracy yields a boring culture. And this book is more about what I wish culture would be like and less about what I wish the political structure would be like. So I wish people would not throw away all their belongings the way that minimalists and decluttering people like Marie Kondo counsel them to. I wish that they would keep their mementos, keep their heirlooms, keep pieces of art in their houses, have tons of books in their houses, as I obviously do. Marie Kondo, at her most ridiculous moment, actually counsels people to throw away all of their books, but cut out the lines that they like and keep them in a dossier of preferred lines, which is so crazy. Or that people would have crazy sex and explore lots of different forms of gender presentation. But mindfulness is another thing that I really don't like. There's a lot.
Yeah, nobody likes mindfulness. Yeah.
Well, some people do. I mean,
I don't even think the mindful people like mindfulness.
I feel like every doctor is like, you should do meditation. I mean, I'm a very anxious person, but that's how I like it. But I wish that people would not do mindfulness. I wish that people would just like have obsessions and fixations. So a lot of my vision is for, I guess, interpersonal and cultural life. And I wish that there were more ambitious works of art. I think another relationship between economic egalitarianism and the aesthetic culture that I envision is that if there were more economic security, there could be more works of experimental literature or film that might not succeed in the market. I mean, there are obviously independent publishers who are doing the kind of thing I have in mind, like in America, New Directions and New York Review Classics are two really good ones. But like, I wish that there were more books like The Recognitions by William Gaddis, like being written now, instead of all these like fragment novels that are 200 pages.
You mentioned you're an anxious person. We seem to live in the age of anxiety. What is the connection, if there is one, between this fashion for minimalism, for decluttering one's life, and anxiety? Do you think if we could burst again as people in terms of our sense of our own narratives, we might be able to overcome the anxiety that seems to have gripped many people in America?
Yeah, I'm not sure that maximalism of the kind that I recommend is a recipe for emotional stability exactly, but I do think a lot of the existential dread and anxiety that people feel comes from a sense of, and I'm just speculating wildly, I mean, this is an empirical question, as my husband, a sociologist, would say, you need to go survey people or whatever, but my wild speculative theory is that maybe people feel so much anxiety because they don't feel really embedded in the communities that they're in or where they are. And I think a lot of these minimalist trends that I critique in the book, one thing that they have in common is that they envision people as isolated units who could go anywhere in the world, excuse me, at any time. That's in fact quite explicitly in a lot of the decluttering guides. And I read like 20 or 30 of them for the book or something. They say that one advantage of decluttering your house is that you can just pick up and go anywhere, anytime. Or the mindfulness people say, like, one advantage of being able to live your life mindfully is that any place that you are, you can kind of detach from it and go into this safe mental zone where you're just taking stock of what you're perceiving and you're not judging it. Both of these things seem to me like recipes for detachment and dispassion, not a recipe for embedding yourself in your life and feeling unalienated from what you're doing, which of course exposes you to other kinds of emotional pain. Like if you're attached to things, you can be upset when they die or when they leave you. But I think that that is a proper part of the human tradition. And so I think that people are kind of being encouraged to shed their humanity. And so that is one source of anxiety.
Do you think we should declutter, or I mean, is your critique of Marie Kondo's decluttering, is it also go as far as that the idea that we shouldn't declutter our own narratives, that when the older we become, the fuller we become, like that fellow in, I think it's a man in the New York restaurant who keeps on ordering pasta. The older we become, the fuller we become, the more we eat, and the more, if not satisfied, interesting we become.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I mean, one particular thing that Marie Kondo recommends is kind of that you get rid of tokens of old memories or old experiences. Like she explicitly counsels you to get rid of like old love letters or mementos from high school or something. There's one episode of her TV show, which I also watched for this, where someone's husband has died and she's basically encouraging the woman to get rid of all of his stuff, which I'm not saying that you should never throw anything away, that you should keep everything in your life, but I do think that these physical things, which are not commodities, not things that you can buy, are emblems of experiences that you've had. And those experiences are what make you the person that you are, as opposed to just an interchangeable blob who could go anywhere at any time. And so I do think that as you accumulate love letters, birthday cards, mementos, other physical manifestations of past experiences that you've had, that's how you are individuated from other people. And that's a good thing.
Final question, Becca. You're obviously very critical of Marie Kondo's utilitarianism. For her, I think the purpose of life is tidiness. What is the purpose of life for you, Becca Rothfeld, finally on this Easter Sunday, this day of supposed resurrection?
So I guess as a liberal, as a Rawlsian liberal, I don't think that there's one answer for everybody. I mean, part of what I love about Rawls is that one way in which Rawls is excessive, which is maybe underappreciated, is that his vision for political life is that everybody defines and pursues their own vision of the good. So it's like a cacophonous multiplicity of visions and traditions all within one polity. And so I think that that's the kind of society that I want to live in, but that means that everybody is in the business of figuring out what they think the good life should look like. My good life looks like reading lots of books. And so that's what I do.
And of course, for the Rawlsian version, we all operate in this veil of ignorance, so we have no idea that we're going to work out well, so we want that safety net, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, although I think that for him, that's like a device to figure out, that's a thought experiment to figure out what the society should be like, but then when you're actually living in the society, you do know who you are, and you're an individual person, and you can formulate your own community according to your own commitments, and that will yield, I think, like, pluralism in practice, which I think is one good form of maximalism.